today on Wings.
I think what's most scary about huge media companies is that they essentially become larger than the public.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Tracy Rosenberg has worked in the San Francisco Bay Area as Media Alliance's executive director since 2007. According to its website, Media Alliance was founded with the belief that in order to ensure the free and unfettered flow of information and ideas necessary to maintain a truly democratic society, media must be accessible, accountable, decentralized, representative of society's diversity, and free from covert or overt government control and corporate dominance. Media Alliance is a media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Unquote. Rosenberg has organized and advocated for the protection and sustainability of alternative media outlets and for fair representation of women and minorities in the mainstream media. Rosenberg has been very active in the battles for net neutrality and against the merger of media giants Comcast and Time Warner. In an afternoon crammed with conference calls about the merger, she graciously fit me in for a conversation about media monopoly.
They're all getting bigger.
Ben Bagdikian, who wrote The New Media Monopoly, now in its 20th edition, says in that book that five conglomerates control 90% of what Americans see, read, and hear.
Yes.
What do Americans have to fear about these conglomerates politically?
I think what's most scary about huge media companies, just as with large corporations in other sectors of the economy, is that they essentially become larger than the public. They become global entities in terms of the resources that they have, the funds that they bring, the political alliances that they make. So essentially, they're functioning outside of the sort of national and governmental borders that have been set up, and these borders, as much as government can be a problem, are really the only way that the public can express their limitations on these companies. So you essentially end up with sort of a global corporate super order. And I think that we're seeing that not just with the natural resources of the world, but we're also seeing it with our information economy and our information resources.
Is this sort of media consolidation happening internationally?
The internet has essentially collapsed borders. We're all getting and providing information across national borders. One of the most read news outlets in the United States is The Guardian UK. So we're not really recognizably talking about national media anymore. We're talking about global information, which is flying all across the universe. So the rules and the regulations and the breaks on this process really don't compute with our national governments and the institutions that have been set up to regulate. They're not working in the right spheres.
Plus, now we have the specter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP.
And the point of the TPP is to essentially collapse government in favor of global corporate hegemony. For natural resources, for the environment, this is a catastrophe. And the question here is, what's the impact for our information resources and for the tools and the methods and the platforms that we use to talk to each other if they too are essentially owned by a global corporate hegemony that answers to no one?
Does the fact that two out of the five major media conglomerates in the U.S. are based beyond our borders mean anything per se?
I don't think that because a media outlet per se is foreign that it's better or worse than a domestic media outlet. What the threat is, essentially, is the size and the comparative power of these entities and the fact that their interests really span nations in terms of the resources that they can marshal and the way that they politically interact when their interests are at stake, which is almost beyond national governments. And it's certainly beyond the somewhat pathetic regulatory entities that are set up.
And how has this been made worse by Citizens United?
Good question. What Citizens United has done is it basically unlocked almost unlimited lobbying and political manipulation resources. In other words, the amount of money that corporations can put forward towards trying to impact government policies entirely in their own short-term financial, often speculative, interests is now so wildly out of proportion to the amount that the public interest can marshal that it's really not even David versus Goliath, which is the normal way of describing these things. We need another biblical story to kind of explain the difference in height between these two entities.
Noah versus the flood.
Exactly. I mean, something really small and something really big.
How much of the search problem is political? And how much is technical?
Well, I mean, you know, the search problem can be said in one word, which is Google, because Google has basically turned search into a monopoly. I know that there are other search engines, and I use them sometimes, but the reality is that Google has set the terms for what search is. And when you have a company that is that large and that influential in what gets clicked on and what doesn't get clicked on, the route to any sort of change goes through that company in a way that's a little freaky when you're talking about something that's that huge. I don't think you're ever going to have a scenario where you can convince people to go back 20 pages of search results to look at things. There's not that much time in the day, and there's too much information out there. So the fight is about what are the criteria for what appears on the front page, and what input or control or regulation can exist regarding that. And it's very difficult because we've essentially privatized search. It's a service offered by a company. They offer it on whatever terms they want. And within sort of a free market argument, we can't tell them what to do. And if we don't like it, we can use some other search engine. Except, as we all know, you really can't. I mean, Google it is a verb because it means something, you know? DuckDuckGo it is not quite the same thing. And I like DuckDuckGo, but it's not the same thing. And, you know, personally, I use Firefox, but, you know, still.
Firefox claims they prefer Yahoo, but I always switch the box.
I have Google set as my search engine because, frankly, I don't find what I'm looking for in other search engines.
The European Commission is charging Google with violation of the European Union's antitrust laws.
And, you know, they're causing them some aggravation and frustration, but we don't even know about it in the U.S. It's like it's not even happening, and it doesn't affect our Google relationship. So the ability of the particular entities trying to act on behalf of the public are smaller than the company that they're trying to impact and the problem that they're trying to impact.
Who's creating the big problems? Is it the publishers, the distributors, such as the owners of the internet backbone, or both?
Well, the question is, are they the same people or different people at this point in time, too? Because, yes, in theory, you have the content providers and you have the providers of the pipes. And in theory, both of them can act as gatekeepers, as censors, as controllers. On the content side, we're more used to that. Everyone knows about conservative publishers and the impact of advertising income on content, which in theory doesn't exist. And in actuality, we find that it exists. When you're talking about pipes, you start to talk about throttling, you start to talk about blocking, you start to talk about technical differences in the way that information is processed that don't have tangible reasons. And that's why we had such a titanic net neutrality battle, which for now has come out in the right way. Whether that's going to stick as we go through this great legal battle, we don't really know. I'm optimistic that it may. But again, that's only a U.S. decision. So when we start talking about global pipes and when we start talking about a global information supply, the problem kind of outstrips what you're able to do within countries and within regulatory environments. Then you have a situation where the pipes and the content are getting married. So you have the ability to gatekeep on multiple fronts. We call that vertical integration, and what it means is content and pipes coming together in the same company. And one of our big examples of that is Comcast, which is also NBC. So they can gatekeep on both sides, and they can essentially work to advance their interests by using their pipes to promote their content, and vice versa. That's a huge threat. Vertical integration of media is one of the biggest threats that's out there. Those of us that are on the radical side of media activism have said for years what we need here is structural separation. If you own pipes, you can't own content. And that is an idea that is apparently too radical for the world right now, but in the long term, that's where we should be headed.
In other words, a Glass-Steagall Act for the media.
Exactly.
The Glass-Steagall Act was an act passed during the Great Depression that prohibited commercial banks from owning investment banks.
Because really it incentivizes an entity exactly the wrong way, because all of their interests collide.
Should the technical side of the internet be nationalized?
That's a good question. I've been a long-term advocate of municipal and community broadband, which is essentially doing that, but doing it in little patchwork chunks, city by city or state by state or nonprofit by nonprofit. And the reason for it is that essentially it's the only competitive option that we have left, because the barriers to entry when you're talking about internet pipes are huge. You can't just really start up an ISP anymore. Those days are gone. It's a huge investment of infrastructure. So basically, you just have a couple companies left, and they are buying each other up rapidly. And so we're heading towards the last two survivors, if we're lucky. It may just be one megapolis in the end. So under that scenario, the question is, how do you create any competition at all? And so public internet infrastructure is one way that you can do that, one of the few ways left. And we see that the big telecoms are fighting it tooth and nail because they can see that. Their route to a non-competitive universe is to wipe that stuff out. In terms of nationalizing, certainly to some degree, by establishing information services as a public utility, we have walked a couple of steps in that direction. But a regulated private utility is not the same as a nationalized service. My personal feeling is that the government would be, number one, overtasked if it were to take over the operation of the information services of the country. And secondly, that we have enough reasons to be concerned about the way that our government is using information right now to have some severe quandaries. And of course, this is one of those devil's advocate choices. Would you rather AT&T had all your data, or would you rather that the NSA had all your data, pick and choose? And the truth is that they both do, and both situations are kind of crummy. If you're asking me to pick which one is better, I don't know what the answer is.
Well, AT&T can give its information to the NSA.
That's exactly what's going on. So I don't think at this point nationalization of the media per se is the answer. If you take a look at someone like Robert McChesney, he would say that you want some kind of national subsidy for sort of public interest media. And maybe that kind of halfway step, like net neutrality, which is also a halfway step, are kind of the best things that we can do right now to keep a little bit of the public interest present.
But then wouldn't the big players like PBS get all the money?
Yeah, that's what you get into, and that's exactly how that would play out. I think that when McChesney was talking about it, and in fairness to him, he was talking about it 5 or 7 years ago, and I think probably his ideas have morphed somewhat. I mean, he was essentially talking about taxing for public media. And that's not going to be real popular. We know that. And it also creates a situation where what we're defining as public media will become very subject to gatekeeping. I think we can certainly think of a couple of stations that are likely to sort of collapse out of the public media definition when it becomes a government-funded service. But what he was concerned about was journalism and who's paying for it, and do we actually have a fourth estate that's meaningful if the fourth estate is broke?
I know that from personal experience. I recently read Ellen Hodgson Brown's article on how America has become an oligarchy. In it, she cited a Princeton study on political decision-making, and I wanted to read the study. But the links to it were stripped from Talking Points Memo and Scrib D because of copyright complaints. The study is available from an academic journal, but it charges $30 to access it. That's 15% of what I'm getting paid before taxes for the article I'm writing, for which I'd want to read the study. Academic publishers have hegemony too, don't they?
Yeah, well, that's something that Aaron Swartz was pushing strongly as an internet activist, which is essentially the walling off of information. When you're talking about academics, it's lead information that's being walled off. And the public needs to be able to see this stuff. It's not a secret. It's the accumulated knowledge of the universe. And as you can see, that didn't go so well for him.
Aaron Swartz was a 26-year-old computer programmer, writer, and open democracy advocate, facing up to 35 years in prison and $1 million in fines for allegedly downloading a large trove of academic journal articles. 5 days after his arrest, Swartz was found hanged in his apartment. His death was ruled a suicide, but no suicide note was found. His many activities included work on the development of Creative Commons. How can something like Creative Commons help?
Well, I mean, certainly Creative Commons was a wonderful effort. Lawrence Lessig deserves a humongous amount of credit. And it has certainly permitted people to try to contribute their content to open source information economy that doesn't punish people for participating in it. But as everyone has said, Creative Commons is a volunteer compliance effort. It works if everybody plays by the rules. When there are bad actors, it doesn't. So it's a system that is a wonderful model and pilot of what could be. It's a utopian idea, but I'm not sure that it has quite enough to it to reverse all of the negative aspects of copyright and to essentially adjust for bad actors.
How do citizens get their media back? And do they want it back?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of conversation within the journalism community that has to do with, well, we want to do investigative whistleblowing journalism. We want to hold government accountable and live up to the constitutional idea that we are the fourth estate. But nobody wants to pay us to do it. Nobody. And there was a certain amount of cynicism about the fact that it was essentially people selling sofas on the fourth page of the newspaper that provided the economic equity for the fourth estate, which is weird. And we never really came up with any kind of alternative model.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Tracy Rosenberg, executive director of San Francisco-based Media Alliance, discussing media concentration.
Monopoly, oligopoly is always an attempt to corner all the money and create scarcity unless you've got the monopoly, oligopoly power. I mean, that's why it's attractive, because you can make it scarce for everybody else. And that has huge advantages for those who own it. Not just the money, but the idea that everyone else can't get a piece of the action. So what can we do to get it back? I think for the interests of public interest media, I think it's been terrifying that people really haven't jumped in with eagerness to pay for it.
A blog article published by the Watershed Media Project called Journalism's Position in the Charitable Giving Ecosystem stated that it turns out, in fact, that for all the declamations and examinations of journalism's importance to our democracy, actually funding its non-commercial public interest practice is one of the lowest priorities of the charitable sector, inclusive of major and individual philanthropy.
And then, you know, you can do an analysis about why part of it people were used to getting it free or very low cost. I think certainly the quality of much of the mainstream media has played a role. I think people have been gravely disappointed with a lot of what they've gotten. And I think it's fair to say most people's encounter with the media is fairly mainstream. They get the evening news, they watch 60 Minutes, they pick up the newspaper, and some of this has been pretty crappy over the past couple years, and there is a question of paying for a product to appreciate what the product gives you, or is it one crime description after another? You know, who needs it? And then you're sending me a bill, and I don't want to pay it. So that's a part of it. For the alternative media, it's a different question, but I think people also have often been frustrated by what they've gotten. I think that the reasons are a little more complex in terms of what people want from alternative media. I think in some cases they want their own perceptions ratified because they feel very alienated by the mainstream. And I'm not sure that alternative media can do that to the extent that people want it to. I think sometimes people want their identity affirmed, which is a very important thing. but it's a very specific thing, and it's a hard thing to do for a multitude of the population and still maintain the affection of other multitudes of the population. I think it creates a difficult situation for alternative media, because really identity affirmation is something that should happen within the social fabric. And the fact that it doesn't, I think, leaves huge unmet needs. So that's a part of the problem, is people haven't really wanted to support a huge, vital information sector out of their pocket. It's also expensive, and we don't have much money. I mean, that's another thing. When you defund the public, when wages are dropping and expenses are going up, and then you say, and by the way, the information society is now paid for by you, allocate an extra $75 a month, people laugh. They don't have the extra $75 a month or $50 a month or whatever it is that we would actually need to have a real information sector paid for by the people. And it probably does cost about that much. And we don't have it. So what are we going to do to get it back? I think we have to start talking about how the public money is spent, obviously. I think we do have to look at what alternative sustainable structures look like. And people are doing that. Low power radio, it's a small scale movement, but it's a movement towards what does sustainable media look like that the people can actually participate in and afford. I think we have to understand that media cannot continue to consolidate. And we have to fight these mergers as if they are really assaults on the public fabric, which is what they are. Every last one of them. I mean, at this point, my opinion is nobody can merge with anybody, period. The specifics of each merger, the specific harms, the specific impacts are different. But in general, we have already passed the point of unacceptable media consolidation a decade ago. There is no upside at this point to increased consolidation. There is no merger that is good enough. There is no merger that is satisfactory. And that's not something that's a commonly accepted point of view. But for me, there is no benefit to increased media consolidation that I can find at all. So certainly on the net neutrality argument, which was essentially around gatekeeper power and fast and slow lanes on the internet, we were able, at least on a national level, for enough people to get upset about what that would mean to them, to really create, you know, an almost unmatched expression of public outrage. Now, I don't think that the issue was won just because of public outrage. I'm not that naive. The public gets outraged all of the time, and it doesn't always help us. But I do think that it presents a scenario where at least the David part of David and Goliath puts up a pretty good fight. And they have to balance the pros and the cons of moving forward with really increased kind of fascist information communication control. So I think it's a process of both the little local sustainable efforts to, as we say, kind of, you know, poke holes or make little bits of space on the local level, and keeping up enough national pressure so that not all of these decisions go badly, and so that the pace of consolidation and surveillance and gatekeeping is not as quick as it might otherwise be.
So the public has to become global too.
Yes, and we're not very good at being a global public. How the people of the world speak as one, we don't know the answer to that. And part of that is the curse of nationalism, which has us identifying as Americans, not as global citizens. And that is also true of Nigerians. They also identify as Nigerians, not as people of the world. But we don't identify the shared interests, and our global corporate overlords have done a much better job of identifying their shared interests, while we sort of don't really have a counterforce to that. The environmental movement around climate change is probably the closest that I've seen of citizens' movements around the world to start breaking down some of those boundaries. But again, it's in the very early phases, and there's a long way to go. And certainly when it comes to media and information, we're like an infant compared to them, and they're maybe a college student. But the people that we're trying to impact here are senior citizens. They've been doing it for a long time, and it's well developed, so we're not even close. But maybe in time we can start to identify what some of that global citizen advocacy starts to look like.
Is the conversation happening?
Well, it's a problem when you essentially peg a fourth estate as the check and balance to prevent governments from getting out of control. I mean, essentially, that's how it was put together. We'll have a fourth estate, and therefore, tyranny will not overtake the people, because this journalism thing, whatever you want to call it, will be a check and balance on the abuse of power. Well, that's a pretty central cog in the whole system, and it isn't working. It's a weak sector, and it doesn't protect anybody from tyranny at all. And I think that is essentially sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if the sector's weak, it can't protect people. If it doesn't protect people, they're not going to pay for it. We talk about these big, huge problems and the need for global citizen advocacy, and the reality is, when the heck do people have time and resources to mount this kind of massive effort? It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Just like asking people, hey, can I have an extra $50 here so we can have a viable alternative media every month? They kind of laugh at you. Well, I'd like to eat. Do you mind?
You have been listening to Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of Media Alliance in the San Francisco Bay Area. Media Alliance is a media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Media Alliance's mission is excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. The website of Media Alliance is media-alliance.org. That's media-alliance.org. On April 23, 2015, the New York Times published an article announcing that Comcast was planning to end its $45 billion bid for Time Warner in the face of, quote, intense regulatory scrutiny, unquote. According to the article, quote, had the deal been approved, the combined company would have controlled as much as 57% of the nation's broadband market and just under 30% of pay television, unquote. Opponents feared, quote, that customers would end up paying more for declining service, that the industry behemoth would use its heft to stifle competition in the budding online video business, and that there would be a lack of independent and diverse voices on television. Comcast and Time Warner Cable consistently rank at the bottom of customer satisfaction surveys, unquote. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Oakland, California.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Special thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, our sustaining subscriber stations, and individuals. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Special thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, our sustaining subscriber stations, and individuals. And especially Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.